Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Erwin Switzer, representing the respondent, Roy Garozzo, on the issue of whether it is unconstitutional to deprive Mr. Garozzo of a mortgage loan originator's license based on a suspended imposition of sentence plea that he made 3 years before the licensing statute was enacted, particularly in light of the fact that the state has made a finding that that plea is wholly unrelated to his professional services as a mortgage loan originator. The legislature has gone too far in exercising its police powers here, and as applied to Mr. Garozzo, the statute is unconstitutional. Now, the Division of Finance does not have the discretion to rule on constitutional issues, and it denied Mr. Garozzo's application for a license. We exhausted administrative remedies and had a petition for review in St. Louis County Circuit Court, where Judge Joseph Walsh agreed with us and found that the statute is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Garozzo. Without that type of relief and without an affirmance by this court, Mr. Garozzo could lose the ability to continue with the profession in which he has engaged for 25 years until at least December 2013. Now, the key facts are these. Mr. Garozzo has an outstanding record of no complaints for 25 years in being a mortgage loan originator. In December 2006, he was charged with a Class C felony in the city of St. Louis, possession of a controlled substance. He was offered and accepted the opportunity for a suspended imposition of sentence plea, and a couple of months later, he was discharged from probation by order of Judge Margaret Neal in the city of St. Louis, and had no conviction. At that time, it had no impact on his practice, on his profession as a mortgage loan originator.
Because at that time, he did not have to have a license to be a mortgage loan originator.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It was only until the passage of the statute that he was required to be licensed.
Precisely, Your Honor. That occurred in 2009 when the legislature enacted this statute. And in enacting the statute, the legislature set it up in a way that strips important discretion from the Division of Finance.
In your opinion, is this statute constitutional going forward?
Your Honor, I think this is only an issue of an as-applied challenge.
Well,
I
understand that. But in your opinion, could the legislature make this a requirement going forward? Even if in other words, if somebody now wants to get a license, and they have a conviction after the effective date of the statute, would it be unconstitutional as to them?
As applied to them, Your Honor, I believe not under any of our theories, because they would be aware of the consequences when they entered the plea. I think that there are four important facts that we have here, and I think it's that combination that makes the statute unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Garozzo. This is a statute that bars anyone from getting a license if they have any felony conviction or even just a non-conviction but a guilty plea for 7 years preceding the application, whether or not the felony is serious, whether or not it's related to financial fraud or misdeeds. The four unique facts that come together here for Mr. Garozzo are these. First, we have a non-conviction. Second, there is not a connection between the state interest, and particularly in this case, we have a finding by the state.
You're saying pleas of guilty, you're contesting all the statutes that treat them like convictions? You're saying you don't treat that like a conviction? I'm sorry.
A guilty plea that with an SIS is not a conviction.
But there's many statutes that treat those like convictions for purposes of being persistent offenders and so forth. Would all those be invalid too if we said that's improper?
Your Honor, I'm not saying it's improper, but what I am saying is that it's a relevant factor here in this combination of factors, because the factor two is that I want to point out is that there is not a connection to the legitimate state interest in protecting the public from financial misdeeds by mortgage loan originators. And to answer your question, there could be some situations where that would a guilty plea as an SIS might be, there might be a valid connection.
But why does there need to be a connection between the type of felony and the business of the mortgage loan originator? You know, what if it was a felony for some type of assault or bodily harm? Why does it have to be something related to, as you're, I think, arguing, a felony related to financial misappropriations or mishandling of money?
Your Honor, under the constitutional analysis, I think under all three of the constitutional prongs that we have, there has to be some connection. Now, you might have in some situations a legislative finding that even a non-financial wrong is an indicator or a relevant factor. For instance, in a situation that I might have thought a non-financial wrong might have been relevant was rejected by the Western District Court of Appeals in the Rayford case. That was the case where a license was denied by the state to be a real estate broker because the person had been convicted and served 18 years for murder. And their court might have said, even though it's not financially related, we could see that it's not a good idea to have right. real estate brokers taking people into empty houses if they're
and
murdered.
And wasn't the state, weren't their hands tied somewhat when the feds said that, you know, if you don't pass certain legislation by a drop-dead date, that we were going to come in and set up the guidelines ourselves?
The state's hands were tied in some respect. That does not make a statute unconstitutional or make it constitutional. The fact that there's a motivation to comply with encouragement from the federal government, it's not a mandate, it is an encouragement, doesn't make an otherwise unconstitutional statute constitutional.
Counsel, I understand your argument that a financial crime might be more connected and there is a provision barring you entirely if you've been convicted of fraud, but we allow impeachment by any prior conviction. If you're, say, a witness in a case, it doesn't matter whether it had to do with credibility or lying or fraud, because that we have traditionally, the fact that you've been convicted has been relevant to your credibility, to your reputation, and so forth. Why wasn't it rational for the legislature, they didn't have to, but for them to say any prior felony conviction, and this is limited to felony, is relevant, and we don't want someone, we want 7 years, I presume, to make sure you haven't committed any other crime before we allow such persons to get this kind of license. We might not make the same decision, but why isn't that rational?
Your Honor, the analysis, that analysis might be more relevant if there were anything in the record, or to my knowledge, anything anywhere in the world that the legislature considered that analysis.
Well, but when we do a rational basis, isn't that what we really do, whether or not there is any rational basis, whether it's in the record or not? And isn't the legislature told all the time that almost all of our crime is related to alcohol and substance abuse? And that's why we've developed special treatment courts to try to assist people in addiction recovery rather than sending them to prison.
Well, neither the state legislature nor the federal nor the Congress gave any indication of any type of analysis like that, and we have a direct finding to the contrary by the state itself right here that there is no relationship. And what we have is a person with a 25-year great record
of
service.
Obviously the legislature has to set general parameters that provide for the safety of people or for protection of people, that you're going to always have exceptions. And if the fact that some individual happened to be, I'm sure there's people convicted of fraud who are very honest and would make good mortgage loan originators, but we can still have a law that says if you're convicted of fraud, you can't be. And that's rational. So looking at him in particular, I understand the concern that he sounds like a fine man, but we're dealing with, is the law permissible that makes a general rule, as all legislation has to do?
Your Honor, my suggestion is that what you would appropriately look at is the combination of factors that we have here, non-conviction, number two, a finding by the state that there is no relationship to his service as a mortgage loan originator. Three, no legislative finding, nothing in the record to indicate that the legislature either state or federal, had any information to contradict that finding of the state. No evidence anywhere that they saw any of the hypotheticals that the court is positing now. And, you know, we're not saying that these are not factors that the state can consider, but the legislation takes a draconian position that says that even the experts in this field, the Division of Finance, cannot consider the individual circumstances.
You're saying it has to have an exception built in to be constitutional? And have the possibility of an exemption or a waiver built in to be constitutional?
Your Honor, it's the four factors that I'm mentioning, if you had three of, in this case, I think you need all four. Every statute would need the exception built in if, for instance, there were legislative findings to make a connection between the statute.
So if it had, say, an education, I'm sorry, maybe it required a college degree, but somebody could prove that they had learned all about this without going to college, would that be unconstitutional? I mean, were any, because this particular, as applied to this particular person, because they had shown by other means that they could do the job?
Right.
Where would this lead, in other words?
That would be not be the analysis. I think the proper analysis is what is the legislature finding is a relevant connection.
Where do we get these legislative findings that you're talking about?
They're often in statutes, not this one. You can also find them from, in this case, since this was inspired by the federal government, the legislative history. But many statutes
we have no state legislative history at all.
We don't have legislative history sometimes.
So when you say look to legislative findings, I don't think I could find one for any statute.
Since we don't have any legislative history. Are all those irrational? Do we have to assume?
You certainly do not have to assume them, to be irrational, but I think when you have the combination of the factors here, when you have the state itself finding no connection, there should be something on the other side in order to uphold the statute in the face of these bill of attainder attacks The key elements of a bill of attainder, and the one that is most disputed here, is whether the statute advances a non-punitive purposes considering the severity of the burden it imposes. And if the function of the statute does not advance the intended purpose, the act is a bill of attainder. I'm quoting the Bunker case, Supreme Court case from this court. That standard is met. Some of the questions that you're raising might frankly be stronger arguments as to my third argument, due process, but I think on the bill of attainder, the standard is much more rigorous. In retrospective laws, there's a lot of potential for mischief if the legislature can come in after the fact and say that somebody who holds a public office or sits on as a judge needs a new qualification. So I think you should focus on
you have time
the standard.
For
thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Now, how is this a rational, what's the rational basis for this? What's the rational basis for saying someone had a drug charge 25 years ago can now not pursue his business?
Well, Your Honor, the clearest rational basis would be compliance with the federal standard. The state of Missouri has an interest in avoiding the friction that could occur between the federal government and the citizens of the state of Missouri if the federal government were to impose its own licensing regime in the state of Missouri. This avoids.
But does that mean we have to apply hypothetically, we have to apply an unconstitutional regulation if it's provided by the federal government?
It would not require us to apply an unconstitutional one, Your Honor, but your question was, what is the state of Missouri's rational basis? It is rational for the state of Missouri to seek to avoid excessive federal entanglements between the federal government and its employees. It is rational, as Judge Stitt suggested, to establish a licensing qualification that says we do not want people who have made a judicial admission that they have engaged in felonious conduct to bear the imprimatur of the state by way of licensure. That is perfectly rational.
This is for a 7-year period, is that
this
right?
Is for a 7-year period of time. Not one case cited before this court talks about any problem with a temporary license denial. That's what we have, a temporary license denial.
How do we know that the feds would have come in and done something as stringent as this or even more strict than this?
They would have done exactly this, Your Honor, because there's a federal statute, and it's in the appendix, which sets forth this exact requirement for federal licensure, 7-year disqualification for a plea to any felony. The court needs look no further than its own rules to consider the rationality of this, Your Honor. If I would direct the court's attention to rule, 3317C and 3729. Those are two rules by which this court regulates whether people can provide sureties on bail bonds. In 2006, this court changed those two rules. Prior to 2006, there was a lifetime disqualification on the ban of anyone who had been convicted of a felony for providing a surety on a bail bond. In 2006, effective in 2007, this court changed those two rules and said you are ineligible to serve as a surety on a bail bond if you had pled guilty within the last 15 years, which means that people who had been eligible to serve as a bail bond surety on December 31st of 2006 were ineligible on January 1st of 2007.
Opposing counsel says that case is the case where we said that was okay, is distinguishable because he's been practicing in this profession and has in fact had a de facto license that you're taking of the profession that he'd already practiced, so it's different from the case Judge Price wrote. I can't think of it.
I'm not exactly sure which case you're referring to because I'm not aware of a case that talks about the bail bond.
Well, a similar concept that where he's saying he basically he's saying he gained a vested right in it by practicing in that area for so long, so that taking it away from someone who's been practicing it is different than saying people can't apply.
Well, I think that is not true, and I would like to direct this court's attention to the case of Ferguson versus Scarupa, 372 U.S. 726. In that case, the state of Kansas decided it was going to regulate the practice of debt adjusting. And it said that the requirement to be a debt adjuster in the state of Kansas was that you were going to have to be a licensed attorney. The statute was challenged and went all the way to the United States Supreme Court because a person who had been in the business of debt adjusting said, wait, you're taking away my business. You can't do that. You have to let me in, even though I don't meet your new qualification. And the court said, no, that is not the case. We are not going to sit as a super legislature on these kinds of laws and evaluate the wisdom or the reasonableness of the legislature's classification. Your opportunity to fix this is with the legislature of the state of Kansas. Similarly, going back to my bail bond analogy, people who were in the bail bond business on the 31st of December, 2006, were put out of business if they had pled guilty to a felony in the last 15 years. This court has already considered this kind of legislation to be reasonable.
Can you address his argument that the test under for a bill of attainder is different and a little harder to meet than rational basis test, and that you have to balance the I'm not finding the note here, but balance the harm to him with the substantial interest you're pursuing? And I know you cite we're dealing here not with an individual official who's alleged to have abused their power, but with a statute that unfairly impacts people who practiced in the profession. I don't know if the case you cited deals with the bill of attainder analysis, but can you tell me why that would apply there to the somewhat different standard where you look at the penalty versus the interest being pursued by the government?
Well, I would direct the court's attention to Selective Service System versus Minnesota Public Interest Research Group 468 U.S. 841, which is a case this court has previously cited. In that case, the court said, severity of sanction is not determinative punishment. All government discomforts could be considered punishments, but some are not the constitutional equivalent of punishment. We look at a 3-stage test. Whether the challenge statute falls within the historical meaning of legislative punishment, whether the statute viewed in terms of the type and severity of the burdens imposed reasonably can be said to further or advance a non-punitive legislative interest, and whether the legislative record evidences congressional intent to punish. In this case, we don't have a complete bar, as I've said already. We only have a temporary bar. So even the first question, whether it falls within the historical meaning of punishment, is suspect. Further, in the balancing question, the balancing question is whether the severity balances against the legislative objective. And the legislative here, objective of every licensing statute, is to assure the citizens of the state of Missouri that they are dealing not only with competent licensed professionals, but with honorable licensed professionals.
Is there any case that addresses opposing counsel's argument that you can't just look at it as a general balancing matter? You have to look at its impact on him as an individual and whether in that particular case it's unfair.
I have found no such case, Your Honor.
We've indicated before there's no, obviously, no state legislative history, but there's federal legislative history. Is there federal legislative history regarding this issue of a nasty felony and whether or not that has a rational basis to the
I did not find federal legislative history that specifically addressed the pled to a felony disqualification. There is included within the appendix pages from the congressional record where Senator Feinstein discusses the recent mortgage crisis we've been through, mortgage loan originators' involvement in the subprime market, how that led to a process that contributed to the recent financial concerns that we're all familiar with. And so there is legislative history that the Congress was concerned to take action to make sure we did not have people putting borrowers in mortgages they couldn't afford for the purposes of collecting money. I mean, that's what the federal legislation is trying to avoid. And it was perfectly reasonable for Missouri to agree, given the problems we've had in our...
But through all the congressional hearings, the financial Congressman Frank's hearings, I don't recall seeing anything that says possession of marijuana when someone was a youth somehow led to the financial collapse of the United States in 2007.
I don't think you'll find that in the record, Your Honor. I agree. But that does not mean...
There have been no criminal charges against countrywide, against any purveyor of subprime loans at all, and especially no finding that possession of marijuana or a controlled substance of conviction of felony D caused the financial crisis.
Well, of course, the court is aware, Your Honor, that legislatures are allowed to attack aspects of a problem and not the entirety of a problem at any given time. And
why is this different from the cases where we had where someone was living somewhere and then we passed a statute that says you cannot, a sex offender can't live within 1,000 feet of a school, and we said, well, we don't necessarily force them to move. This person had a business, an ongoing business, and now there's a new law that says now he doesn't have an ongoing business.
Those cases talk about whether there is an affirmative duty placed upon the person by reason of their past criminal activity to do something. In the case I think you're referring to, the FR case, Your Honor, the person was required to determine whether the place they were going to live was within 1,000 feet of a school. They were required to post a sign on their door that said, we're not giving out candy. I can't actually remember what the sign was supposed to say. They were required to make sure their light wasn't on. If Mr. Guerrero is the way I've been pronouncing it. I'm sorry. I know that's wrong. If he wakes up in the morning and he goes to sit in his recliner and he sits in his recliner all day, he's not violating this law. If he goes to bed, wakes up the next morning and does the same thing, he is not in violation of this law. There is no duty imposed on Mr. Guerrero to do anything absolutely anything under this law, and there is no argument that it's retrospective because no duty is imposed upon him to do anything.
But your opponent argues the duty is he has been able to be a mortgage loan originator for years without a license, and now under the statute he's required to do to get a license, and that is what is a duty is now imposed upon him.
But it's not problematic that he's required to get a license to do that.
It's not because he had a felony that he has to get a license. Everybody has to get a license.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But if he had a felony, an SIS, a deep felony, he then cannot get a license.
He can't get a
temporary license, but not a permanent license.
He can't get any license until it's been 7 years after his plea, Your Honor.
What's the difference between making somebody move and making somebody get a new job?
The way the court articulated it in the FR case, Your Honor, and I realize that there was some, you know, that was not a unanimous opinion out of this court, is that they said there was a duty to determine whether the place you were moving was within 1,000 feet of a school. And then we had the additional requirements that affirmatively made you post a sign, that affirmatively made you turn off your light, or at least determine whether your light is on.
So in this case, you have a duty to determine whether you have to have a license.
He already knows that.
Well,
how does he know it without finding out?
Well, he applied. The record reflects that he knows it.
The difference, of course, is that it didn't say people with prior convictions must get licenses and people without prior convictions do not. That would be imposing a new duty on him solely because of his prior conviction. Whereas here, everybody who wants to in an ongoing manner operate as a mortgage loan originator must have a license, and it has numerous requirements like school, like different kinds of things, and everybody has to have them. And one of them is you can't have prior felonies, like there are many other things. We would have to overrule numerous cases dealing with licenses and saying you can impose requirements for licenses going forward that consider past actions as part of the requirements.
You're right, Your Honor. There are numerous licensing schemes that provide either a disqualification or a permissible disqualification based on plea to a felony. I can't even count the number of licensing schemes that have that as a requirement. I see my time's expired. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Hi. Thank you. I would like to address Judge Fisher's question because I think it gets to the heart of it, the rhetorical question, what is the difference between moving or getting a new job. Mr. Garozzo has to change his practices for the past 25 years. It changes the status quo.
Wouldn't that be true for any other requirement he couldn't meet, though? So, I mean, every requirement he didn't meet, he can say, well, I'm sorry, it stops me from practicing my profession. You could never put in licensing requirements that are intended to improve a profession, make it safer, because it might exclude someone who used to practice it. But that probably is the legislature's point, is they want to raise the level of practitioners.
If there is some evidence that doing it by this way...
That's a different issue than the retrospective, whether rational basis, that's not part of it. If you're saying you can never impose a requirement that would exclude someone who used to practice, that would apply across the board to any licensing requirement we put in.
But that's a triggering event for the analysis, Your Honor. This court, earlier this year, in the Gurley case, put aside this question because it didn't have to. That dealt with license for a private investigator, and the court said this was a due process analysis, but it would be different if the licensing scheme were enacted after the fact.
It said it wouldn't address whether it would be
Right, but the court left open the question. The court certainly did not consider the situation we have here.
And so I'm asking you to answer, if we were to agree with you and say it makes a difference that he's been practicing this and this would prevent him from practicing his profession, why wouldn't that same argument be made to say no other new requirements can apply? That you can't say someone has to have gotten a master's degree in order to be a licensed physical therapist, which now you do. It used to be you could practice with a BA. There's many, you know, would that be unconstitutional to apply to someone who started going to school thinking they could get the license at the end of college?
Not standing by itself, but in combination with a state finding that element is unrelated and the lack of any finding in the legislative history anywhere. In fact, lack of any finding, not just in the legal file, the lack of any evidence anywhere in the world that there's a connection between a non-conviction for a minor non-financial related offense and being a good mortgage loan originator. There's zero evidence that was put forth by the state here. It's the combination of factors that that makes the difference. I don't want to make it sound like I had overstated my case, because I'm not trying to say that the state has to think about how this would impact Mr. Garozzo. There's this class of people that is a small class, but a not hard to imagine class of people who are not convicted, and dealing with a situation where there is no connection, in fact, a finding of no connection to the legitimate state interest. Judge Heidelman, you referred to some things that happened 45 years ago. If the court would allow me to mention something outside the record, but there's been publicity about a matter a couple weeks ago. A person who'd been working for Wells Fargo was fired because 50 years earlier he had spent 2 days in jail for putting a cardboard dime in a coin machine, and the Wells Fargo said that they had to do that because of a statute enacted about the same time as this statute, motivated by the same thing. And there's going to be legislation, there's going to be litigation over that, and legislators were saying this is not what we intended. I'm looking to the court to say that the legislature went too far in reaching to Mr. Garozzo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.